Well, it is a great joy for us to have you with us over these couple of days, and we're going to have a great time together. Are we on there, Chris? Are we okay? Good. Just a quick note on facility, a few wrinkles in our facility. We're going to have three main stations over the course of the next couple of days, this obviously being the place where we'll meet for our general sessions and our worship times and preaching services. And then right below us in what we call the Commons is set up for our workshops. We're going to have two sessions today that we've called Stories from the Front. And I'm really looking forward to these times. A couple stories of what God is doing in terms of revitalization in a couple churches in our state. And so that's going to be a more informal atmosphere downstairs. You can bring some of the food into there, and we'll have our business session down there as well. Be a good context for interaction there. And then over in the family center or the gym area, there's the food and the display areas, and you want to make sure you make your way over there too. So, I was smiling a little bit. What did I have down here? 9 years ago when we last hosted this conference. And, there was a rainstorm that night. I'm thinking a Monday night in particular. And the esteemed Dr. Greer was still with us and, was speaking that night, and in the midst of a very profound exposition of God's Word, he paused and said, the deacons might want to know that there is a leak directly above the pulpit. And we had just moved into this facility like a month previous to that. I mean, our heads were spinning, and our deacons were glad to know there was a leak above the pulpit. I don't think we'd had a Sunday where it had rained yet. So a lot of fun for us, too, to be involved in hosting. John chapter 4 is going to be our text today. If you want to join me there, I encourage you to do that. Most of you are old enough to remember the name Kodak, right? Some of you, right? I know I'm showing my age here a little bit, but Eastman Kodak was the largest film company in the world. If you don't know what film is, talk to me afterwards. Bring you up to speed, but Kodak had a dramatic fall and ended up declaring bankruptcy in 2012. And the issue with Kodak was that they failed to make the transition from traditional film to digital media. Kodak was aware of the new technology. As a matter of fact, in 1975, it was a Kodak engineer who made the first digital camera. But they didn't run with it. Sony ended up producing the first digital camera in 1981. And that was really the pivotal point that I want to draw attention to in Kodak's story. A man by the name of Vince Baraba was the chief marketing engineer for the company, director of market intelligence. And they were talking about the new Sony camera that had just hit the market. And is this something that should concern them? And Baraba said there's bad news and there's good news. The bad news is this has the potential to be a game changer. This has the potential to put a traditional film business like ours out of business. That's the bad news. The good news is we've got a good 10 years before this really gains traction. It's not too late. And he was right. There was time. But Kodak was very resistant to change in terms of a corporate culture. And they didn't make that shift. They made the mistake of thinking that they were in the film business, when in reality, they were in the photography business, the image business. They lost sight of who they were in the midst of trying to maintain their traditions. And I'm going to suggest to you today that, I'm going to say this in the collective sense, as a council, we're suggesting that we have, as a fellowship, an identity crisis. And we wrestle with the fact that that's not a real positive statement, you know. We don't say it with any degree of angst. I'm not angry today. I didn't grow up in a regular Baptist church, but in the 20 years that I've pastored in this town and in this church, I have grown to love and respect and value the partnerships and friendships that are represented in this room. So I don't say it in a caustic way. I just say it. We have an identity crisis. It's not to say that God isn't doing great things through His church here in Michigan. There's a lot to be thankful for. Tremendous surge in financial support by the churches within our fellowship. There's more oars in the water now, by far, than there were 3 or 4 years ago. And so there's some really exciting things. There's some good buy-in. There's some good ownership, some good collegiality. You're going to hear some inspiring stories of strategic revitalization. So you're going to leave encouraged. But I would continue to say that we have an identity crisis. We need to be honest about where we're at as a fellowship. Our fellowship was established, in the bigger picture, was established as a reaction against liberal doctrines in the 1930s. And we've always been pretty well known for what we're against. But we've not always had a clear sense of what we are for. We have a clear theological identity, but we've lacked a clear missional identity. We know our Bibles, but in part we've lost the ability to communicate truth in our culture. We're a mature fellowship. Many of our churches are over 60 years of age. Many of those churches have run a life cycle of rapid growth, plateau, some measure of decline. Many are culturally backwards. Many are inward focused. Most are notably white, even in areas that are not. We are Kodak. We are Kmart. We are Sears. Solid? Look in my garage. Solid. But a bit out of touch. Now you might take issue with that. Might not be a fair assessment of the church where you pastor or serve, but this is the word on the street. This is what we are known for. This is the overarching trajectory of our fellowship. Our council at a state level has wrestled with this issue of identity over the last few years. What is our brand? What do we want to be known for? What is our niche? What kinds of churches are we seeking to cultivate? And we've had a growing burden as a council that our role is not simply to test the wind and sort of maintain the peace, but at some level we have been charged to set some pace for us as a fellowship. And so over the last couple of years we've put forward a tentative list of core values. Actually, kind of put that forward more formally last year at the state conference. And since then, the regional fellowships have been engaged, and we've received a tremendous amount of very helpful input. There's been some good ownership and consensus that has been building around those core values. We've altered terminology. I think we have those here. We've altered some terminology. We've narrowed the list from 7 to 4. And really, over the course of the next couple of days, we're going to look to the scriptures in these 4 domains. And we've recognized that in setting some type of proactive pace that we might lose some churches. And we understand we're a fellowship of autonomous local churches. So every church is going to kind of make a decision as to whether these things reflect who they are or aspire to be. But this is where we're going, and we feel that we have, we feel that it would be better to have a fellowship of 100 vital, cohesive churches with a clear mission than to have 200 churches that are marginal and lacking in clear identity and direction. So it gives you just a little pulse as to some of the things that we're trying to process through. And so as we look to John chapter 4 today, we're really going to consider this second value on the list, and that is engaging our neighbors. So specific terminology, we'll kind of talk through it as we move through this text. So let's look together John 4, beginning in verse 1. Hear the word of the Lord this morning, this afternoon. Now, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, He left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman from Samaria came to drink water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and come here." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. So the level of intensity around Jesus' ministry is continuing to rise. We know, particularly in John's gospel, that Jesus had a very clear sense of timing. He would slip away when there was pressure and antagonism and when his life was being threatened because his hour had not yet come. And so true to form, as that controversy around him began to grow, he slipped off from the big city up to the rural region up in Galilee. John the Baptist had been the lightning rod for conflict there in Judea, but now Jesus had eclipsed John, and Jesus exits to go to Galilee. And he passes through Samaria, and he encounters this soul-thirsty woman. And certainly, as we look at this passage, we ought to see ourselves primarily as this woman, right? Except that we're even more removed from God's covenant promises. We, for the most part, don't have Jewish blood in our veins. So as a starting point, we ought to see ourselves here in God's great grace and Jesus even extending the good news, the message of the kingdom, to half-breeds and ultimately to non-Jewish persons. But in addition to that, we also see a very helpful model here for how to engage thirsty people. And that's what I want to draw attention to here in the time that we have this morning. I want to suggest several things that should mark our interactions with thirsty people who need the water of the gospel. The first of these is this, that we are to put ourselves in contact with thirsty people. Jesus purposely and intentionally put himself in this woman's path. It was necessary, is the language of the text. He had to, verse 4, pass through Samaria. It's language of necessity. We know some of the dynamics here between Jews and Gentiles, or the Jews and the Samaritans. The Assyrians during the exile had sent many of their people to populate this area, and they had intermarried with the Jews that lived there, and so they were mixed ethnically and they were mixed religiously. They had never been able to shed all of those pagan religious practices, and so they were looked down on by the Jews. It would have been possible to go from Judea in the south to Galilee in the north without going through Samaria. Jews did it all the time. But there was a sense of compulsion here. There was a sense of mission that was driving Jesus' decisions. And so he put himself intentionally into contact with this thirsty woman. Not only did Jesus cross geographic obstacles, but he also crossed cultural obstacles. Not only speaking with a Samaritan, but a woman, and not just any woman, but a woman of questionable moral character. And he also crossed emotional obstacles. She is on guard, right? The nature of her, why are you talking to me? You're not supposed to be talking to me because of my gender and because of my ethnicity. And his humble posture breaks down those initial barriers, right? By asking her for a drink, he affirms her personhood and her value, and he disarms her hostility. Jesus comes to her not simply in power, but in weakness. He puts himself in contact with her. Some of you hopefully know the name of J.C. Ryle. He was a minister and ultimately a bishop in the Church of England. But he was one of the good guys. He was calling the Church of England in the post-Reformation, the post-Puritan period, he was calling the Church of England to ongoing reform, right? Ryle was a good guy. But he was, at a later point in his life, was appointed the bishop there in Liverpool. And he was immediately thrust into controversy because there was a major push to build a grand cathedral in Liverpool. And people wanted to know what his thoughts were on it. And this is what he said. He said, "I only know that my first and foremost business as bishop of a new diocese is to provide for preaching the gospel to souls now entirely neglected, whom no cathedral would touch." Right? Ryle had a sense of sort of what was the nature of gospel ministry, and it couldn't be contained within the four walls of a building. The fact is that there are a great many people who will not walk through the front door of your church facility. Jesus encountered common people on the streets and in the marketplaces, and we need to go also to where people are. We're not high church pastors, right? We're among the people. So we looked at terminology here, talk about engaging, to actually coming into contact with people, to occupy the attention of a person or persons, right? And we talked about neighbors, not just our community in general, but people. Putting ourselves in contact with people outside of the church. These are people checking out to us in the grocery store, checking out next to us. Hopefully they're not, maybe they're checking you out in the grocery store, but they're checking out with us in the grocery store, right? They're sitting next to you in class, person in the next cubicle, and maybe even more specifically, we're talking about Samaritans here, broken people. Might be the LGBT community or the local trailer park or single parents in a local public school, the special needs individuals in your community. Easy to take pride in our missions budgets, but are we effectively engaging our own neighbors? And I'll be honest with you, I never feel like my sermon is ready. Never feel like the emails are answered. Never feel like the next meeting agenda is finalized. And so for me and for you, I think it needs to go on our calendar. I think we need to purpose out of necessity and intentionality to put ourselves in contact with Samaritans. It's not the pastor's work alone, but the pastor will be the one who sets the tone. Number two, present the thirst-quenching satisfaction of the gospel. Now, Jesus is going to bring her to a full awareness of her sin, but I find it interesting that that's not where he starts the conversation. He talks to her about the gift of God there in verse 10. He suggests to her that he could provide her with living water, fresh water, as opposed to stagnant water, life-giving water. And this water would be of such a character that it would transform the individual so that they themselves would become a spring of water bringing refreshment to others, right? It's just this beautiful picture that he casts for her. The living water phrase was somewhat ambiguous. It allowed her to continue to think about real physical water. And she's thinking, you know, who is this guy? You know, she says to him, you don't have anything to draw with. This well, Jacob's well, was over 100 feet deep. He had nothing to draw with. That's why he's asking her for water. So how is he in any way offering me water? And this is the water that was of really good quality. It was one of the freshest wells in all of Israel. This is the well that Jacob, our forefather, gave us. Is this guy really suggesting that he could provide me with an alternative that's even better? She doesn't understand, but she is intrigued. Jesus stirs her heart and captures her imagination. She doesn't really get what this water is, but at the end of the exchange, she wants it. Right? There's just this beautiful picture that is conveyed to her. We have a young man here at Forest Hills. His name is Adam. He's actually not so young anymore. He's married and has been for a couple years, but Adam came from a really dysfunctional home, and he started attending our church in his high school years at the invitation of one of our families. Adam really never knew his father. He was raised by his mom, who was a practicing lesbian, so her partner lived with them. Just a kind of a convoluted, really challenging situation. And he found here at Forest Hills family long before he really understood his sin or his brokenness. And I had to have a conversation about that at a certain point. He's sitting under the preaching of the Word of God, and I knew he had never responded to the gospel. But he was not nagged or argued into believing in Christ. It was a compelling vision that was set before him of what the gospel offered. And I know we're in an age that diminishes and downplays sin, and we need to talk about sin, right? I cringe. I have to be honest with you. I cringe sometimes at Facebook posts and interactions. Sometimes I'm afraid we win the argument, but at what cost? How many people never hear? How many people are turned off to the gospel before they ever hear it? How many people have determined that you're not the type of person they would ever talk to about real heart needs? I'm talking about angry Facebook posts and Republican rants and memes that have to do with the right to bear arms and whatever other issue is so important to you. We ought to be caught up with the beauty of the gospel. We ought to present the thirst-quenching satisfaction of the water that Jesus alone brings. That woman who's covered with tattoos, insecure, needs to know of the greatest marking of all. That high school boy who loses himself every night in his video game world needs to know that there is an infinitely greater alternative reality that is available to him. That alcoholic needs to know that there's a whiskey that will numb the pain in a way that Jack Daniels never will. Okay, I'm not sure about that approach, but you get what I'm talking about. Thirsty people will only put down their water pitcher when they find something better than water, right? 1 Timothy 2, look at it on your own. Number three, gently bring people to an awareness of their true thirst. Again, she's intrigued by Jesus' offer. She's tired of coming to this well each day, but she still doesn't recognize her soul thirst. And so Jesus drives the conversation deeper, but in an indirect way. Go get your husband and come back and let's talk. She hopes to diffuse the situation by simply saying that she isn't married. That's true. But there's considerably more to her story, and Jesus fills in the gap. She'd been trying to find her satisfaction in relationships. He could have just told her that she was a soul-thirsty sinner. But instead, he brings her to a place where she recognizes her own condition. That she's been looking for something and hasn't found what satisfies. Often Jesus does this with a question. Here he uses a request. But he draws this woman gently to an awareness of her true thirst. J.C. Ryle, again, long before he was bishop in Liverpool, took his first post at a little rural hamlet called Fawley, population 400. And he talked about the challenges of plain speaking. Love this. It is an extremely difficult thing to write simple, clear, perspicuous, and forcible English. To use very long words, to seem very learned is very easy work. But to write what will strike and stick, to speak or write that which at once pleases and is understood and becomes assimilated with a hearer's mind and a thing never forgotten, that we may depend upon it, is a very difficult thing and a very rare attainment. C.S. Lewis said something similar. Matter of fact, he received a great deal of criticism because he was so powerful in apologetics, right? Mere Christianity. This was kind of the first genre of his books. But by the end of his life, he's writing children's books, and he would get invitations to conferences, come and speak. But we want you to speak. We want you to do mere Christianity. We want you to come and do apologetics. And he said, I don't do that anymore. He said, I found something better. I found how to put apologetics in the language of children, to put it on the bottom shelf. And quite frankly, that's where I'm going to invest my time. So he said this, you must translate every bit of your theology into the vernacular. This is very troublesome. And it means that you can say very little in half an hour. But it is essential. It is also of the greatest service to your own thought. I've come to the conviction that if you cannot translate your thoughts into uneducated language, then your thoughts were confused. Power to translate is the test of having really understood one's own meaning. Tell you what, we've got a group of Chinese students, about 30 of them, the second of which just came to Christ in the spring and was baptized 2 weeks ago. The vast majority of them are unbelievers. Has rocked my world. Trying to think of how to communicate the gospel in ways that's going to capture their hearts. And we've started doing the last couple of years a 4-seminar overview of Christianity in 4 lessons. And every time I turn around at the material, I'm like, no, they won't understand that. I mean, it's just driven me to have to think about how to really communicate and really reach into their hearts. And we need to develop these kinds of skills. We need to get rid of the canned approaches. Jesus used a different approach every time. Same gospel, different approach every time. Because he was learning and listening, and he knew it was how people were oriented and what was important to them and what metaphors would resonate with them. We need to learn to ask good questions. Here's a great little book that has exposed some things in my own life in this realm of asking questions, of leading people to discover their own condition, right? I found out that I ask a lot of testing questions. I ask questions because I'm looking for a piece of information, usually something out of the text that I want to make sure they see. But a good question is a question you don't know the answer to. I shouldn't be asking questions to find out what I already know. I'm asking questions to find out what I don't know. And so we need to just develop competencies in these domains so that we can, like Jesus, draw people to an awareness of their true thirst. I mean, Jesus obviously had supernatural knowledge of this woman, but I'm not so sure her situation was such a mystery, right? She's there by herself at noon, She was an outcast. She was a broken woman. And we ought to be looking to draw people as Jesus did. Finally, keep focused on the gospel. Keep focused on the gospel. Jesus goes into this exposition about her history and her past and how many times she's been married. And she says, I perceive that you're a prophet. And so she asks Jesus to weigh in on the major dispute between the Jews and the Samaritans. Where should we worship? The Samaritans thought Mount Gerizim, and they had history on their side. This is where Abraham first constructed a temple. Gerizim looked over Shechem. This is where Jacob bought property, which he would eventually give to Joseph. This is where Joseph's bones were buried when Israel entered into the Promised Land 400 years later. There was a lot of rich tradition here, but Jesus, of course, drives home the point that the Jews were operating not from history, but from revelation. And God had established Jerusalem as the place to be worshipped. But in the midst of that little trivial issue, Jesus stays on point. And he says, essentially, the point is not where you worship. The point is how you worship. And he didn't allow the red herrings to diffuse the conversation. I really think that's what's going on with this woman. Why did she ask this? What did this have to do with anything? It had nothing to do with anything. I think it's a way of diffusing the situation, right? It's a redirect. And Jesus continues to come back to the real issue. I don't know about your kids, but my kids have mastered diversionary tactics. I mean, it's the explosion of emotions in the living room, you know, where they've been playing indoor soccer. This never ends well, right? And my 9-year-old is saying, it's not fair, you know, and here's my 13-year-old who's, you know, wagging the finger and just scored 5 goals on him, you know. It's not fair. And he's punching his older brother. And I'm like, I don't care. It might not be fair, but your reaction is wrong either way. Let's just cut through it here, okay? You're wrong. We learn some of those skills as parents, but I think we need to learn those skills too when we talk about our faith to people. Might be scientific theories on the origin of the earth. Might be the Crusades. It might be all those hypocrites in the church. It might be the church's stance on individuals who identify as LGBT. And we allow those little arguments to get us off track from the gospel. Those are important things. Well, that person doesn't need to live a moral life. That person needs Jesus. They're never going to live a moral life until they come to know Him. So we ought to keep the focus on the gospel. Our time's almost gone, but that's really not the end of this account. We next encounter in this last section the hungry disciples. That's another plot line that's developing here. Verse 27. Just then his disciples came back. They marveled that he was talking with a woman, but no one said, "What do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with her?" So the woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, "Come, see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ?" They went out of the town and were coming to him. Meanwhile, the disciples were urging him, saying, "Rabbi, eat." But he said to them, "I have food to eat that you do not know about." So the disciples said to one another, "Has anyone brought him something to eat?" Jesus said to them, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Do you not say there are yet 4 months, then comes the harvest? Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes and see that the fields are white for harvest. Already the one who reaps is receiving wages and gathering fruit for eternal life, so that sower and reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true, one sows and another reaps. I send you to reap that for which you did not labor. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labor." So these disciples come back. They're not real interested in this evangelistic opportunity that just happened. They're not breaking down Jesus' approach. They're rather disgusted, actually. They've been out finding food, and this woman is a distraction. "Come on, Jesus, it's time to eat. We're hungry." And Jesus tells them that he has had other food to eat that they weren't aware of. Now it's their turn to be confused, right? It's not only this woman who's trying to figure out what this living water is about. It's the disciples now who are having to think about what this real, true, soul-satisfying food is. Here they are. They've embraced the living water. They've received it. These are believers. But they're looking to find their satisfaction and their joy and their fulfillment in things that will never satisfy their hunger. And Jesus unpacks for them that we will only be satisfied when we join God in His work, and that the fields are ready to be harvested. Here is the food. This woman was not a distraction from lunch. She was lunch. If you lift up your eyes, I find it interesting that these accounts are not dealt with serially, one after the other. Rather, they're dealt with simultaneously. They are interwoven here so that we're meant to see the comparisons as we move through the story. The fact is that we are often looking to find satisfaction, even as believers, in the wrong places, just as much as this woman was looking to find satisfaction in the wrong places. She got it. She puts down the water pot, goes and tells her fellow villagers. These hungry disciples had yet to discover the satisfaction that comes with participating in God's harvest. They're focused on a meal that will only leave them feeling hungry again in a short time. Will they find their satisfaction in doing the Father's work? Will you?